It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, more Wisconsin businesses are switching to solar energy, but for nonprofit groups, the cost of installing solar equipment can be a challenge. We'll hear how third-party financing is allowing many to make that transition and why it faces an uncertain legal future. First, the Republican leadership in the U.S. Senate is facing more opposition and new obstacles to its health care plan. On Saturday, White House officials made their pitch to attendees at the National Governors Association meeting, but concerns remain even from some key Republican governors. And with the narrowest of margins for success in the Senate already, an unexpected complication over the weekend made immediate passage even more unlikely. Alex Bolton is a senior reporter for The Hill. He's been following the progress of the Republican health care plan. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this Governor's Association meeting, a bipartisan one, I understand it's usually not a highly watched event. This time was different because of health care, right?
Yeah, Vice President Mike Pence was there and Tom Price was there, and they were making the argument that, you know, that this is a bill that needs to pass, and they were, you know, giving it a strong sell to the governors, making the argument that, look, this is what you guys have always wanted, which is more freedom to design your Medicaid programs. And, you know, I was a governor, and he was there with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Administrator Seema Verma, who helped him in Indiana design a program to essentially expand Medicaid, but without, you know, more federal resources to tailor it to the state's needs. And he's saying, look, you know, and that's something similar to what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin. And he's saying, look, you know, we are giving you the freedom to, you know, set these programs up the way you want them. So, you know, this is a good bill. You should encourage your senators to vote for it.
What are the concerns from governors, especially some key Republican governors?
Well, their concerns are that this is going to be cutting, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade in federal spending on Medicaid. And so that is a shared federal-state responsibility. If the federal government is spending less, that means either the states have to spend more or they have to retrench their services. And if they do, you know, those poor people who are sick, they don't go away. They're still there. And so, you know, the states have to deal with them one way or the other. And I think that's why you're getting such strong pushback from the governors. The other thing the governors are concerned about is in states like Ohio and many states around the country, you know, there's a serious opioid epidemic. And a lot of these people who are addicts are being covered by the expanded Medicaid enrollment that was made possible by Obamacare. And so the question is, if you are then capping the federal contribution for expanded Medicaid enrollment, then, you know, how are we going to get the money to treat these people who are suffering with addiction?
Of course, this would be a Senate vote, and governors get exactly zero votes in the Senate. Why is the White House pitching this so hard to governors in particular?
Well, I mean, governors are often the most powerful political players in the various states. So if a governor is saying that this bill is a terrible bill, and, you know, it makes it a lot tougher for the senator to vote for it. I mean, a good example of that is Nevada, where Brian Sandoval, I think, has something like a 64% approval rating. I mean, he's one of the most popular governors in the state. He is adamantly against this health care bill. He's very concerned about it. The first version he was adamantly against. The second version, it's been revised. You know, he's taking a wait-and-see approach, but he remarked it hasn't really changed. Dean Heller, the senator from Nevada, he's the most vulnerable incumbent in 2018. So if he's running for re-election next year and Brian Sandoval says this is a bad bill and Heller votes for it, then that's a political problem for Heller.
We're talking to Alex Bolton, senior reporter for The Hill, looking at the latest political roadblocks to the Senate Republican health care bill. Let's move on to the Senate floor itself. The road not much smoother there. The vote delayed because of Senator John McCain having a serious health problem, apparently. First of all, what do we know about what happened to Senator McCain?
Well, his office released a statement that he had a craniectomy, which essentially they took out a small portion of a skull right above the right eye to clear out a blood clot, and it was a pretty big blood clot. We don't know exactly, you know, where it was, whether it was between the skull and the dura, which is basically the sheath, the casing of the brain, or whether it's between the casing of the brain and the brain itself or in the brain. I mean, it's unclear as to where exactly, you know, the hemorrhaging happened. It's unclear, you know, what the cause of it is. The New York Times wrote a piece today kind of laying out the possibilities. There isn't a whole lot of information coming from McCain's office, but, you know, there's you know, it could be benign or it could be more serious, and we just don't know. But the bottom line is that, you know, McCain's not here. I mean, he's, you know, he is 80 or around there. You know, he's of advanced age, so when you have a procedure like that, it makes it very tough to fly. So the question is, you know, when are they going to get him back to Washington? There's some talk about, well, maybe we need to drive him back to Washington. But, you know, it's very hard to imagine that he gets here, you know, before the end of the week, and it could even be, you know, 2 weeks before he's here to vote. And, of course, the Republicans have 52 seats. Two Republicans are already against the bill, so you need everyone there. Everyone needs to be present.
Right. Of course, a lot of people's first thoughts for Senator McCain's recovery, but the margin is so thin. There is no margin, basically, for Mitch McConnell. They need every vote. With John McCain, at best, they would have 49 votes, not enough.
Right. So if McCain's not there, the bill does not pass.
And he's not the only one people are worried about here. There are other senators who haven't said they're going to not vote for it, but they haven't necessarily said they're going to vote it, including Senator Heller in Nevada. You wrote a piece recently looking at some of the key senators to watch. Who are you keeping an eye on?
Well, the other ones, I mean, you know, Heller is a big one. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, you know, she is kind of, she has raised similar concerns to those expressed by Susan Collins, who you mentioned earlier in the program. Collins, you know, one of her problems, and Murkowski shares this problem, is that this bill will impose a stricter formula for indexing Medicaid inflation in 2025. And so Murkowski worries that this is going beyond the scope of Obamacare. Obamacare didn't really get into traditional Medicaid reform. And so by adopting a more stringent or less generous formula for Medicaid inflation, Murkowski says that, look, we're going beyond the scope of our mission, which was to repeal and replace Obamacare. This is going beyond that. Other than Murkowski, there's Shelley Moore Capito, Republican from West Virginia. 29% of West Virginia is on Medicaid, making it, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, you know, the state with the highest percentage in the country. So Medicaid cuts are going to hit West Virginia very hard. Ohio Senator Rob Portman is very concerned because he represents Ohio, where there is a raging opioid addiction epidemic. And so, you know, he's worried about what you're going to do with these people who are, you know, being kicked off Medicaid, how they're going to get their opioid treatment. And also, you asked about the governors earlier. John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, he is staunchly opposed to this bill. So it makes it tougher for Portman to support it. So, you know, those are a few, and then there are others as well. I mean, John Hoeven of North Dakota has expressed concerns. Jerry Moran of Kansas has expressed concerns. And, you know, in Hoeven's case, you know, North Dakota expanded Medicaid enrollment under Obamacare, and he's just wondering if the resources are there to cover the people who are going to lose coverage.
What happens if this thing doesn't end up coming to a vote? Is there a plan B in the wings?
Not really. If this thing doesn't pass, I think they're going to move on to other issues and let it kind of sit for a while. You know, there's talk of putting together a, you know, bipartisan plan to, you know, bail out the insurance industry. That's kind of a pejorative way of saying it, but they need to come up with some insurance stabilization plan. I mean, there are a bunch of counties that don't have any insurers participating in Obamacare exchanges. And then there's a large part of the country where, and this is something that Pence talked about at the Governors Association, where there's only one insurer participating in some of these marketplaces. So, you know, there's just no competition as envisioned by the bill. I mean, that's a problem. And the reason why you have these insurers pulling out is because the costs are prohibitive. So, you know, there's a recognition in the Congress that they need to pass a insurance stabilization fund, which is going to cost, you know, tens of billions of dollars, to incentivize insurance companies to begin participating again in these exchanges, so people then have some options when it comes to buying health insurance. So that's not a small fix by any means, but, you know, that's something that probably gets shelved for a while. I think they're going to move on to tax reform and other issues before they go back to that.
With this delay for now, I've seen people read it both ways. It's good news for Mitch McConnell. Some people say it gives him more time to win over people who might not be on board, Republican senators who might not be on board. Other people say, no, this is bad news. It gives more time for people to protest and work on Senate senators from their state and highlight potential damage to their state. Do you have a read on what the latest conventional wisdom is on that?
Well, I mean, look, if there was an advantage to McConnell for delaying this bill, he would have, you know, it wouldn't take John McCain's illness for him to delay it. I mean, it was in his strategic interest to move this as quickly as possible. You know, that's the way things are usually done if you're trying to pass a big bill, you know, here in Congress. And you know, that it really kind of blows up McConnell's plans. I mean, he wanted to vote on this before the July 4th recess. There's a rebellion. He had to postpone until this week, and now McCain's sick. And so this thing is going to be dragging on for 3 weeks in the Senate. And, you know, that is contrary to his plan. So, you know, people are spinning it and saying, well, it gives us more time to get information out to the governors and to sell the bill. But right now, outside groups are significantly outspending the groups that are supporting the bill. So there's a lot of negative advertising out there. And so it's hard to imagine how, you know, keeping this thing. One GOP strategist can compare this to a pinata. You know, the longer it sits out there, the more blows it takes before it collapses. So I think this is a dangerous setback for the bill.
Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Alex Bolton, senior reporter for The Hill. He joined us for an update on the progress of Senate Republicans trying to pass their replacement for the Affordable Care Act. Right now, businesses powered by solar energy are more common than ever, but for many, the cost of installing solar panels is still too high. It's especially tough for nonprofit groups like schools, churches, and cooperatives that can't take advantage of tax credits for renewable energy. A lot of these groups are getting creative and partnering with investors to share the cost, but regulations are vague and there may be some legal roadblocks. Carrie Leiderson joins us now. She's a professor of journalism at Northwestern University and writes for Midwest Energy News. Carrie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
So what's going on here is called third-party financing, which sounds kind of dry. Explain what that is to us.
Yeah, that's a mechanism that has really made solar accessible to a lot more institutions and nonprofits and even individuals, because that's where the homeowner or the church or the school that has the solar panels on its roof doesn't actually own them outright, but another entity owns them, and then the actual owner of the property either essentially buys the energy or sort of leases the solar panels or in some other way gets the energy from the solar panels without. So the big benefit is that the entity that has the solar panels on their roof doesn't need to put up all the capital up front to buy them. And it's especially good for nonprofits, like you mentioned, who can't take advantage of tax incentives, or even, you know, private individuals for various reasons might not benefit from a tax incentive. So having another entity own the solar array means that they can get the tax incentive, and then the whole solar installation becomes more affordable for, you know, the end user because of that.
So if I have a business, I can get a tax incentive to do this. If I'm most kinds of nonprofit, I can't. Are these big enough incentives that it's that big a difference maker?
It is, yeah. I mean, we're talking, a couple $1,000s or more, depending on the size of the array, because right now the investment tax credit is worth 30% of the solar installation. But, you know, if you don't owe that much in taxes, it's not going to help you. And that really could be the difference between, you know, in the thousands of dollars can definitely be the difference between being able to afford a solar array or not for a lot of institutions or people.
So are there companies that specialize in doing this kind of third-party installation and, I guess, financing arrangement?
Yeah, there are a lot of different companies and solar developers that do it. And there's all different ways it can work. One of the ways that's actually really exciting is a company would, you know, might be the main owner or the one that collects the tax incentives, but then people in the community, if you're talking about you know, like a grocery cooperative or a church or a school, people can in the community can actually still contribute to making it possible, because they can buy shares. That's a little bit different arrangement, but similar, called community solar, or they can actually buy bonds. A lot of times the installation is financed through bond sales, so by the, you know, the company that spearheads it all, and then individuals can buy those bonds specifically because they want to support the project and, in a sense, have ownership of it.
as I understand it from reading your piece, there's some gray area, though, when it comes to laws and regulations that deal with utilities. What are some of the concerns?
Yeah, so, you know, nationwide utilities, a lot of utilities have really pushed back against the spread of distributed solar generation, which is, you know, essentially rooftop solar, because it can be a threat to their business model. When people make their own energy, they don't buy as much energy from the utilities. So there's been a lot of different ways that utilities, especially in Wisconsin, have tried to make it more difficult to get rooftop solar panels. And trying to curb or even outlaw third-party arrangements is one of the tactics that utilities have taken in Wisconsin and in Iowa and other states. So the argument that the utilities make is that, you know, they're essentially regulated monopolies. Like, I can't just start my own utility and compete with your existing utility. So the utilities say that if a third party owns, you know, a solar panel on my house and sells me the electricity, that company is acting like a utility and is encroaching on their monopoly, and that's illegal. That's a legal argument that makes third party a little bit tricky. But if you look at it from kind of a common sense point of view, you know, if I'm just getting electricity from a solar panel on my roof that happens to be in part owned by another entity, obviously that other entity isn't actually trying to compete with Madison Gas and Electric or We Energies. And this is decided usually on a state level or by the public utility commission, and sometimes by legislation in a given state. So in Wisconsin, it has been murky, specifically because utilities have tried to prevent this from happening. But the takeaway right now is that it's actually possible and it's happening, and solar developers and solar advocates feel pretty confident about it despite any legal uncertainty.
We're talking about solar power right now and efforts to help nonprofits, various kind of nonprofits, from churches to schools to co-ops, get solar panels on the roof with an outside party putting them on, third-party financing. It's called. Carrie Leiderson is with us. She's a journalism professor at Northwestern University. She wrote about this for Midwest Energy News. Has this hit the courts much, Carrie? And if so, what have we heard from courts if these things are challenged?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, We Energies had tried to ban third-party ownership, and Solar Advocates actually took it to court and won, with the court saying that, essentially saying that they couldn't ban it outright, and also that the utilities need to use evidence, to sort of, you know, science-based evidence when they make cases like this before the utility commission. So that was a real victory, but it didn't get rid of all uncertainty. It basically said that, you know, things, the utility would need to challenge individual third-party owned installations on a case-by-case basis. And then in Iowa, there was a big victory for proponents of third-party financing in the state Supreme Court. The utility alliance had taken the solar developer to court, making the argument I described before, and essentially lost. So that was, you know, a big victory for solar advocates in Iowa. And since these are our state, playing out on the state level, each state has to fight its own battles. But solar advocates do feel like that victory in Iowa, you know, has, if not legal precedent, has sort of larger, trend-setting precedent for other states. And in Wisconsin, what solar developers and advocates are saying is that they're actually pretty happy with the status quo right now. They don't think utilities will want to push it into the courts further, because then there could be a decision like in Iowa that's actually negative for them, for the utilities. The solar people are pretty happy with how third-party financing is possible right now.
And speaking of trend setting, is this something, this third-party financing to get solar panels on these nonprofits, is this, you know, just here and there, or are we seeing it pick up steam?
I'd say it's definitely picking up steam. At the same time, solar panels are just becoming more affordable. So, you know, it may pick up steam less once it's less necessary, because it's just easier to afford solar panels, period. But from what I understand, it's definitely, you know, been picking up steam and will continue to for a while.
And when these groups have these panels on the roof, are they paying just kind of a monthly amount, or do they meter the electricity like a utility would based on how much they're using from those panels?
Right. So there's all different ways you can do it. And one of the innovations and the ways to get around any legal murkiness is to come up with different creative ways of structuring the deal. The sort of most basic way would be that one company owns the panels and charges either a set monthly amount or actually charges for the amount of electricity generated. If you charge for the specific amount of electricity, that's where it gets legally a little more dicey. So it's kind of better, legally at least, to pay a set amount each month. But then there's even more complicated and probably legally stronger setups where you could have multiple owners, or, you know, the church could own like 5% of the installation and another company could own 95%, or you could have even more owners than that who all kind of share the ownership. So, you know, and these companies understand the business really well and are always coming up with new models and new ways to make it more financially beneficial and legally sound for everyone.
Between new financial arrangements and, as you mentioned, the lower costs of solar, are you expecting to see just a lot more solar springing up on rooftops over the next couple of years?
Definitely. I think everyone really expects that. The speed with which it happens and, you know, how much more does depend a lot on utility, you know, on rate cases and utility rate structures that are decided by the utility commission, and also on different tax incentives. But I don't think there's any doubt that rooftop solar will continue to really grow, either somewhat quickly or very quickly, depending on those different factors.
Carrie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Carrie Leiderson, professor of journalism at Northwestern University and writer for Midwest Energy News. She was with us to talk about the growing number of nonprofit groups turning to third-party investors to finance their switch to solar energy. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For a lot of people, that classic Loverboy song needs an update. Everybody's working through the weekend. There's a lot of reasons for that. For some people, email and cell phones and the internet keep them on the clock every day of the week. For others, on-demand scheduling makes days off unpredictable. And many people work in jobs that require overtime, mandatory workaholism. Whatever the reason, the idea of two consecutive days of leisure, whether it's Saturday and Sunday or two other days, can be hard to find. And when we do get that leisure time, we may not know what to do with it. Our next guest says it's time to push back, to take back the weekend, and really appreciate our time off. Katrina Onstead joins us now. She's a journalist and author, and her newest book is The Weekend Effect, The Life-Changing Benefits of Taking Time Off and Challenging the Cult of Overwork. Katrina, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Well, are we losing our weekends that it took a lot of history to get to?
Yeah, it looks as though we are. You know, it sort of depends where you are on the work spectrum, of course. But for most white-collar workers and people in the knowledge, what they call the knowledge economy, there have been a real increase in the amount of hours that are worked per week. And even for those who might not actually be logging more hours, there's a sort of a sensation of working longer because a lot of people are existing in this state of high alert, constantly checking in with work or being available to work during those 48 hours where we used to actually be severed from the workplace, right? Now we kind of can carry our offices in our pockets and on our person, even when we're not physically at work, we're at work, right? Or at least thinking about work or performing availability.
And you compare the United States to other countries and Europe. People work a lot fewer hours. There's more respect for the time off, except maybe, and this is depressing, except in the UK, where a lot of people call overwork, I think you said, the American disease?
Yes, it is really depressing. This is, so the UK is a bit of an anomaly in developed Western European economies in that they also have a real long hours culture, and the sociologists there have labeled this the American disease. So it's one place where being compared to America is not really a positive thing. But, you know, as in the States and as in Canada where I am, there are people who are kind of working against this and have decided that, enough is enough and that this isn't really sustainable.
And you mentioned this as kind of a performative thing. Not only do we work a lot of hours, a lot of people, we brag about it. We wear it sometimes as a badge of honor, don't we?
Yeah, it's a really funny.
Whoop.
Apologies. A funny thing has happened where, you know, the leisure class used to be celebrated for having a lot of free time, but now, in fact, what accrues status is not having a lot of time, right? And I think everyone probably knows those moments of competitive busyness that people engage in where you run into someone and say, how busy are you? How tired are you? I'm more tired. I'm more busy. And in fact, there's been a lot of research on this, and we found that the idea of being exhausted and overworked is actually a little bit of a status symbol right now. And of course, it's, you know, incredibly unhealthy, and it actually doesn't make you a better worker to be working longer hours. It doesn't affect your productivity in a positive way. It actually makes you less productive.
And that's from the individual level, but from the level of the employer, obviously some employers expect this kind of devotion to the job, overtime, constant availability, or maybe they set a sales target that no human could meet without working 60 hours or whatever a week. What kind of changes would you like to see from employers?
Well, I think employers need to get real because there's no real business case for burning out your employees. We've known for about 100 years, and they keep retesting this research, and it always pans out, which is that after about 40 hours, workers aren't making any more widgets. Or if they are making more widgets, whatever that widget might be, it would probably have some errors built into it, right? So the work that you're going to get out of people, even if you are forcing them to, you know, be locked down in their workplace, is not going to be of a high quality. And more innovative workplaces are beginning to recognize that and experiment with three-day weekends and, you know, one longer shift. I spoke with a woman who runs a company in Scotland, a PR company, and they work, you know, four 9 to 10 hour days, and then they take three day weekends, and they found this to be incredibly rejuvenating. So I think that what employers need to do is start thinking a little bit outside the box and realize that this model, this kind of these long hours is something that's left over from the Industrial Revolution, this idea that being present in the workplace and being exhausted is a sign of success, that in fact it's not serving their bottom line to treat their workers that way.
We're talking to Katrina Onstad. Her new book is The Weekend Effect. She says work is more and more taking over weekends, and we're losing a lot because of that. And Katrina, let's get into that point. What should we be getting in our lives? And this is a lot of what your book is about, but big picture, what should we be getting out of those two or three or whatever consecutive days off?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, leisure is something that isn't held in really high esteem right now in many places. But in fact, leisure is so important for many reasons. First, of course, there's the physiological and the psychological benefits of taking a break, of actually resting mind and body. There's also a public interest question at play here, which is if we don't have time off on the weekends, when do we gather? When do we participate in our communities and our societies? We know that social isolation is on the rise. Reports of loneliness have increased. And many of, one of the factors there is that people just feel they don't have time to really connect with other people. And it was, for me, researching this book, that was actually my biggest sort of takeaway and revelation was just that, oh, yeah, we're so tired often on the weekend, and our lives are so busy that we look at de-stressing as kind of collapsing alone in front of the TV or, you know, those things we do to make us feel immediately better. But in fact, it's reaching out to other people and engaging in more high-value activities that bring the benefits of the weekend.
You end your book actually with a manifesto of things that we should be trying to do once we reclaim that time off. And one of them, you were just talking about that social isolation. One part of your manifesto is connect. So how can we take that weekend time off or that day off, and instead of using it to veg out and collapse and recover, make sure we leave some time to connect with other humans?
Well, I mean, I think it's, there's so many things. I mean, first of all, what we talked about first, which is a reimagining of how we work and our relationship to time and work, which isn't something that people can necessarily do on their own. Yes, we have some agency in these questions, but there also needs to be a kind of social recalibration about what we expect from people who work. So there's that. If we have, if you do have agency and you can take that time, being with other people has huge benefits. Participating in the community, there was actually work done around volunteering and how volunteering makes people feel, and it was really interesting. It said that people who volunteer don't feel like they have less time. They feel like they have more time, like their actual experience of time changes. And I think a lot of us don't reach out into our communities because we think, oh, we just don't have time, or, you know, it sounds boring or pious or whatever. But in fact, it will make you feel better. You will feel rejuvenated, and you'll actually feel like you have more time in your weekend if you're doing something altruistic or involved in the place where you live.
And you talk in your book about this feeling of anger and alienation online and people being really hostile to each other. And you connect that to this idea that we're not connected with each other in person. We don't recognize humans anymore in some ways when we're interacting online.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. We're at once more connected than we've ever been and not that connected at all. And there's something about human physical contact that's incredibly powerful, right? I think we know that intuitively, even if we don't have the energy to pursue it. And, you know, the biggest force there is empathy. It takes being around other people to activate those powers of empathy, to look in someone's eyes, to be in their physical presence. So even if you have a very active social media life and you might feel, oh, I do know what's going on with my friends or my family, or we are communicating and I'm posting these pictures, it's not exactly the same thing. It really won't affect you. It won't give you those calming feelings, endorphins, and the kind of sense of purpose and meaning that real human connection does. There's lots of value in social media and in having those kinds of communities, but they're not equivalent. It takes getting out and into the world to actually feel like part of the world.
Katrina Onstad is with us. Her new book is The Weekend Effect: The Life-Changing Benefits of Taking Time Off and Challenging the Cult of Overwork. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does the weekend mean to you? What does it look like for you? Does your job creep into your time off one way or another? What is important about leisure time, and what makes you feel like you got your time's worth when you have time off? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Katrina Onstad. She's the author of the book, The Weekend Effect. She says we're losing the weekend and we need to take it back and enjoy it, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is important about having a weekend? What do you do when and if you have 2 days off? Does your job interfere one way or another with getting that time off? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Carson is with us in Sussex. Carson, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I absolutely agree with everything being said. However, I think there's also a connection to the status that the economy is in right now. It seems like we're living in an age where we have to work this much. And maybe, like, the things that we need to afford are, like, a cause and effect of, like, working so much. Well, now I have this anxiety. Well, now I have to be able to afford this medication for this anxiety. It just feels like an endless cycle the way that it's going right now.
And Carson, can I ask what kind of work you do?
I actually work at a nonprofit for adults with disabilities. So I help train them with job skills so they can go out and be contributing members to society, be independent, stuff like that. And at that kind of a career level, I'm not, you know, making boo-boo bucks. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a lot of money in health services. However, it's very necessary to have those positions filled.
Carson, thanks a lot for that call. So Katrina, Carson in a low-paid line of work, and she says for her and a lot of people like her, they have to work a lot to be able to afford things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad that she called. You know, fragile economies breed this kind of relationship to work, right? It's not just performance; it's livelihood for many people, especially the gig economy, right? People patching together four or five jobs to add up to one job. You know, there goes your weekend for sure. What she identified is actually something called the work spend model. It's something an economist called Juliet Shore has named, which is this cycle of working to have enough money to spend, but then having been spending too much and having to work more, right? So consumption is another thing that will eat up the weekend. So in my book, I talk to a lot of people who have sort of stepped back, stepped off that treadmill and are trying to leave a lighter footprint and consume less. And that's often it's not easy, but it's one way to get back your weekend is to participate less in the kind of constant consumption, which might ease up on the need to work. Not always, of course. We know that some people just aren't in a position to choose these kinds of things. But I'm really glad she called, because that is such an important thing to notice, like how much consumption plays into how we work and how we spend our free time.
Carson, thanks for that call. Katrina, you also write about some people are thinking about the idea that, okay, we've got some businesses who have a few staffers and are making them work a lot of hours, and there's a lot of people out there unemployed or underemployed who'd like to work more hours than they currently do. What are people talking about to try to balance that out?
Yeah, I mean, so where I live in Toronto, what we have right now is a real boom in this kind of precarious work, right? So people, I think it's 50% of the city I live in, a very large city, are now considered precarious workers, people who don't have worker protections and don't have the kind of standard 40-hour work week built into their contracts, and they're going from contract to contract. This kind of way of living is becoming increasingly problematic for people. Obviously, it's extraordinarily stressful. There's some research that suggests that working precarious or contract work is actually more stressful for people than being entirely unemployed. So we're seeing some kind of grassroots movement around that here, and I think that this is also happening, and I know it's happening in New York, and I'm sure there's something going on where you guys are as well, around advocating for protections for workers so that if you are going from contract to contract, you will still be assured some time off. And this is something I think lawmakers are really going to have to start looking at, because people in that kind of precarious work are not going to be great consumers. They're not going to be buying houses and participating in the economy. So we need to ensure that people have some kind of secure work and secure leisure.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Milwaukee. Matt, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comparison between an older time decades ago and a time now, using myself as an example, and then also briefly mention what I believe to be one of the primary culprits. Look at the Brady Bunch, where the husband was an architect, and he had a large family and a stay-at-home mom, two cars, and a maid. Well, that wasn't a fictional story back then. It was fictional, of course, but that was a real possible scenario back when that sitcom was made. Now, I myself am an architect. I've got a small family. I've got to work two jobs. I don't have any new cars. I've got used cars. I spent a couple of grand on. I can't get a new car. After student loan payments and a $1,500 a month rent, I can't even afford health insurance. And at the end of the day, even I make a really good rate wage and I work two jobs, I've got nothing to save. So, and I think the large culprit of it, the Federal Reserve Central Bank, which started in 1913, has dropped the value of the dollar by 99%. I'd also add at the very end, I don't think the answer is to steal money from some people and give to others from those according to ability to those according to need. Isn't necessarily the answer, but more of a definitely support people, help people, and get awareness about the Federal Reserve. And
Matt, thanks for the call. So expenses changing, Matt's saying over the years, we can't live on that one job and still have a weekend and raise a family and pay rent and et cetera, Katrina.
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, stagnant wages are playing into the erosion of the weekend, no doubt. People do have to work harder and the dollar does not go as far. The other thing that he said that I thought was interesting was, you know, talking about the Bradys, is that the introduction of women into the workforce actually hasn't meant that women are working less around the house. So for a lot of women talk about the time crunch and how their weekends are filled with domestic chores and child rearing. And then on top of that, now they have, you know, full-time jobs. So leisure for women has actually decreased, even as women have entered the workforce. And we've seen something called the gender leisure gap, where men are much better at kind of attacking their leisure and laying a stake in leisure and saying, I'm going out for my regular basketball game, whereas women really, it looks like, don't do that as much. And they're feeling the brunt of the kind of, you know, cultural burnout.
Talking to Katrina Onstad, her new book is The Weekend Effect. We go now to Nate in Adams. Nate, hi.
Hello there. I just wanted to comment. I grew up with little or nothing. When I hit about 16 years old, I decided that was not the life I wanted to live. And I work hard, and I'm not bragging. I was able to retire at 50. Everything I have is paid for. I owe no one a nickel. If I want something, I buy it. I don't live all that high, but it's pretty easy. I think one of the things that they're doing is teaching the millennials and maybe the generation just prior that 40 hours a week is a terribly high amount of hours to work in a week, and they should be able to only have to work the 40 hours a week, if that much, but have all the top shelf toys. And it doesn't work that way.
Gotcha, Nate. So it's an expectation thing, Katrina.
Yeah, although I might push back a little bit against that because, in fact, when people have been surveyed, I think it's like 60% of Americans say that they're working between 50 and 60 hours a week, which is quite a jump from 40. And millennials, I think, are obviously the biggest you know, victims, I guess one might say, of the gig economy. They're kind of underemployed or half-employed or contract to contract. And I don't know how much, you know, that's a desirable position for them. So, you know, I'm always wary of kind of condemning an entire generation for not working hard enough. And I think that, yes, hard work absolutely has, you know, so much value and benefits, but it's not always available to everybody. And I think we need to be, you know, empathetic to people who are trying to work as hard as they can, but there really aren't the jobs out there. And especially millennials, that's a really underemployed cohort. You know, that's a very serious issue.
Time for one more quick call with Emily in Superior. Emily, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I'm heading back for my weekend right now. It lasted from Wednesday to today. I'm a teacher, so the whole summer is my weekend. And I think it's about living within your means. I'm only a second-year teacher. I've got two small kids and two dogs, and my husband just took a job. So we do everything that we want to do, and sometimes we have to cram it into our weekend. But you got to choose your life path and make your weekend your life.
Emily, thanks for the call. Katrina, just a few moments left. Leave us with some advice on when we have that time, making the most of it.
Well, I love what that caller just said, actually. I think, you know, living within your means and not getting caught up on the kind of work spend treadmill. And when you do have that time off, fill it with activities that aren't just kind of the decompression Netflix binge watch, but in fact hold value. Being with people, hobbies where you're kind of can experience a sense of flow and get lost in an activity. And really prioritize your weekend the same way that we're so good at prioritizing work.
Katrina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Katrina Onstad, journalist and author. Her newest book is The Weekend Effect, The Life-Changing Benefits of Taking Time Off and Challenging the Cult of Overwork. If you're a fan of the HBO series Game of Thrones, or if you know someone who is, or if you ever look at the internet, you know that the show kicked off its long-awaited new season yesterday. I have a question for you in just a minute, but first, my deal with the Game of Thrones show is I watched it for a while, but then I bailed out. Why? It's because I'm a big fan of the books. I'm waiting for the next one to come out eventually. I liked the show for a while, but it started to stray from the plot of the book, a little bit at first, more and more as time went on, so Just going to stick with the original. Now, here's my question for you. What is your favorite or least favorite book to movie or book to TV transition? What movie or TV version of your favorite book really nailed it? And which one got it wrong? Or if you came at it the other way around, you saw the, you know, the screen version first and then read the book, how'd that translation go for you? You can let us know. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I mean, out there, you know, maybe it's the Harry Potter. You love the movies. You hated them. They didn't live up to the book. Lord of the Rings. Thought the Lord of the Rings movies did well. The Hobbit. What? That just didn't get the spirit of the book at all. I watched the first one. I'm done. You have thoughts, I'm sure. Books to movies, books to TV, your favorites, and your failures. Central Time Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network.